Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm Joe Matthew in Washington alongside Kaylee Lyons. This is Balance of Power. I wanted to have ears on not only the president, but a series of cabinet officials here with a lot of news. Kaylee, dozens of headlines on the terminal over the past 90 minutes, reiterating, by the way, he will visit Texas and survey the flood site on Friday. But much to be said about trade, beginning, Kaylee, with a 50% tariff on copper. This is the one headline that went red during that extended conversation. 50%. We're watching copper prices move. Freeport MacMoran on the move as well. This is one we didn't see coming today.
No, we knew it could come at some point as an investigation had been launched looking into copper specifically. But it is news to us that this will be imposed effective today. He also warned of more sectoral tariffs that could come, including things we've heard a lot about, pharmaceuticals, chips, for example. He threatened a 200% tariff on pharma, but suggested that could be more than a year out. And of course, he reiterated that August 1st is the new deadline after signing an order yesterday to officially move the date from tomorrow, July 9th, to August 1st. He suggested it's not a change, it's a clarification. And he also said the trade letters he's been sending out are equivalent to a deal. He said a letter is a deal.
He said it's always been August 1st, which is curious because we had been counting down to a July 9th deadline.
Yep.
We're not even there yet, but indeed it is official. August 1 will stick with that. A lot of deals going out soon, he said. Countries giving us total access now. It's too time consuming to make deals, he said. Therefore, the letters that are in the mail.
Yeah, and more could be coming throughout the course of today or the coming days, according to posts he made on Truth Social earlier. So we want to get into all of it now and turn to Bloomberg Washington correspondent Tyler Kendall, who is live at the North Lawn of the White House for us. So, Tyler, clearly a lot of talk about trade, but plenty else to chew on here from this cabinet meeting.
Yeah. Hey, Kaylee. A lot about trade, as you mentioned there. Of course, the news when it came to copper was the big headline out of this. We didn't know the date or the rate, but we did know that this was coming. U.S. imports of copper surged to a record high in April ahead of these expected tariffs. But it likely is not welcome news to our trading partners who are negotiating the so-called reciprocal tariffs. And that's a really interesting thread to pull on here, since we know that the sector-specific tariffs have really complicated these talks. But our original understanding of these tariffs that are enacted under Section 232 on national security concerns is that they weren't supposed to be negotiated, but we have seen them really come into the discussions when it comes to some of our trading partners, such as South Korea and Japan, particularly around autos, but also steel and aluminum. When it came to him hinting at the future for pharmaceutical tariffs, that's likely not going to be welcome news for the European Union, which President Trump said could see a tariff letter in the next 2 days. That was quite the development, considering that our understanding had been that these letters were going out to the trading partners that the U.S. was most frustrated with when it came to the ongoing negotiations. But we've gotten some indications that there actually had been progress when it came to the European Union. So a lot of different threads to pull on there, but trade definitely did dominate the conversation. He said that these letters could reach up to 60 or 70%. Joe and Kaylee, that would be quite the escalation, considering that we've really only seen marginal differences with the tariff rates so far outlined in these letters.
Talked about the Fed as well, Tyler, suggested that Jay Powell should resign immediately, said he's always late, and appears at one point to be telling Scott Bessent in that conversation that he likes him better than Powell. There's an important piece of news that we learned in this meeting as well, Tyler. Benjamin Netanyahu is coming back to the White House tonight. What do we know about this?
Right. So according to the Israeli Prime Minister's office, they will be meeting here at the White House at 6 p.m. Eastern. Of course, this comes after the meeting that we saw yesterday, followed by that state dinner. And we did hear from the special envoy, Steve Witkoff, during this cabinet meeting, who said that he felt they were making progress towards this idea of a 60-day ceasefire. This is something that the Trump administration has put forward, but the discussions have, of course, been complicated. We did see Israel send mediators to Qatar over the weekend in a sign of support for the administration's plan, but we haven't really gotten updates on how this had been progressing. Except for that, Witkoff did say that they were nearing some sort of agreement that could see 10 living hostages released. As we await more details, we could hear later on from the White House about exactly how the future of negotiations are going to evolve. But of course, a significant development that the Israeli Prime Minister is coming back for a second meeting.
Well, and Tyler, elsewhere in geopolitics, the president reiterating that he's not happy with Russian President Vladimir Putin right now after yesterday, saying that the U.S. will continue to send defensive weapons to Ukraine after the Pentagon had tried to put a pause on that. Quite a shift in policy and tone.
Right, exactly. Quite a shift, considering him saying that he is upset with the Russian President Vladimir Putin and also praised Ukrainians for his their bravery in his words. He did say that they are going to send additional weapon stockpiles to Ukraine. He didn't exactly elaborate on what kind of weapons, but did say that they would be defensive artillery. It was after this brief pause that you mentioned where the U.S. was assessing our stockpiles. Interesting to hear the President of the United States talking about the DIB, the Defense Industrial Base, which we often touch on, this idea that the Pentagon wants to see it revitalized, considering that a lot of the pushback, perhaps, when it does come to sending aid abroad has been from some of those conservatives that want to see our own stockpiles built up first in the United States. But the Pentagon does have some of these more bureaucratic methods when it comes to building up our industry. So President Trump, clearly they are trying to push forward some sort of momentum to get these sides talking. We do know that he spoke to Zelensky most recently on Friday, Joe and Kaylee, the president saying that ultimately these conversations, this push towards a ceasefire, is proving more difficult than originally expected.
Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live at the White House. Tyler, thank you so much. As we watch this cabinet meeting resolve here at the White House, I want to add the voice of a member of Congress, not here in Washington, but Brian Babin represents Texas as a Republican and is a member of the, in fact, chairman of the House Science Space and Technology Committee, the 36th District. Kaylee, thank you so much. Congressman, great to have you with us here on Bloomberg TV and radio. I'd like to ask you about some of the issues that we heard discussed in this cabinet meeting. But as chairman of this important committee that oversees the National Weather Service, and as a member of the Texas delegation, I want to ask you about President Trump's plans to visit the flood zone on Friday. Is this the right time for him to be there?
I think so. I think, you know, we've already had Kristi Noem down there, the DHS secretary, the state of Texas, our Texas Department of Emergency Management, the governor, the lieutenant governor, my colleague in the House of Representatives, Chip Roy, who represents that stricken district, have all been there doing a yeoman's work. Even NASA, which I represent and have jurisdiction over, our committee does at any rate. NASA has aircraft that are flying down there. Air National Guard has MQ-9 Reaper drones that are going up and down the river valley looking for people as well. This is the search and rescue. We're still in it. And we are determined to find everybody that was lost. And then we can start talking about what we can do to go forward. But we want to do things that will never allow this to happen again.
Well, and in that vein, Congressman, understanding that you obviously have a personal connection to a lot of the affected communities here. Your granddaughter, we understand, attended Camp Mystic and left shortly prior to the floods. We wish you and your family well. Experiencing this, yes, as a Texan, as a human being, but also as chair, as Joe mentioned, of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, does the National Weather Service need to do something different in the future to ensure this doesn't happen again? Do you have a preliminary understanding of what went wrong and what needs to be fixed?
Well, I don't have a complete understanding. I mean, it's a little early. Like I said, right now, it's search and rescue. These hard questions are going to be answered, though, I can tell you. We're going to have some hearings. I'll give you an example. The president's budget that came out, the Office of Management and Budget came out with what they call their skinny budget. The Trump administration is not cutting the National Weather Service. It's they got $66 million more for FY26. They have only spent about half of what they have current year funds as well. So they were fully funded. They were fully officed, fully staffed. The system, I think, is working as intended. We lost lives, and that means that absolutely we've got to do more. And I'm the chairman of the science committee, and we're going to conduct a thorough review of this event, and we're going to ensure through that legislation, like the Weather Act reauthorization for one, is focusing on improving forecast communications, local coordination, and continued technological advancements and innovation. Our goal is going to be very, very simple, and that is to make sure that communities have every single advantage when severe weather does strike and ensure that NOAA and the National Weather Service is able to meet those goals and protect lives and property. And that's what we're going to do.
Are you getting what you need from the federal government? I know President Trump has offered the help that's needed, but what does Texas need now that it may not be getting?
Well, I think we have a lot of volunteers. We have, as I said, NASA has contributed aviation itself. We've got a lot of people that are flying over that river valley. People are walking up and down that river valley, miles and miles, and it's tragic. They're calling their children's names out. There are people who have, in fact, there was, I just saw on television just a second ago, a young man was looking for his parents and hasn't been able to find them. He's sticking with the program. He's not going in. He's going to continue to work, to walk. He wants to find other people's lost loved ones. This is what I think Texas is all about. And, you know, these camps, you ask about my history with these camps, and I can tell you these girls and boys camps have been there for a century. My father-in-law went there as a camper, a camp steward for boys. As you said, my granddaughter was in the first term of session at Camp Mystic, and I had a second granddaughter that was supposed to be in the second session.
Wow.
But she was diagnosed and she injured her knee, and she was unable to go to the second session at Camp Mystic because of a torn meniscus. This is the first time it was a godsend.
Wow.
That we could say that spared her from who knows what.
Yeah.
So she
got well, to have we're thankful that your family is okay, Congressman, and we appreciate you joining us here on Balance of Power. That's Republican Congressman Brian Babin, representing the 36th District in Texas, chair of the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, with us on Bloomberg TV and radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Keeping an eye on the markets and the reaction we're seeing in copper to the president's announcement during a lengthy cabinet meeting at the White House that just wrapped up moments ago, that 50% copper tariffs will be implemented effective today. Of course, that's not the only news the president made on the trade front. He also suggested that more letters are coming for trading partners, setting the rate of tariffs they will pay effective August 1st. And interesting, Joe, to hear him characterize the date change from what was supposed to be tomorrow's deadline, July 9th to August 1st, not as a change, but as a, quote, clarification, maybe.
Yeah, maybe was the key word there. It was July 9th. I think the market's been pretty obsessed with that. It is now August 1st as of yesterday. He said more, too, suggesting that it's too time-consuming to make deals, instead that a letter means a deal. And this is where we start with our political panel today. Rick Davis is with us, of course, Bloomberg Politics contributor and partner at Stone Court Capital, a Republican strategist alongside Jeannie Shanzano, senior democracy fellow at the Center of the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Great to see you both here, and thank you so much for your patience. This was a more than 90-minute long cabinet meeting. Rick, is Donald Trump getting bored with his own trade policy here? He says it takes too much time to make deals.
Takes too much to make deals, but he's not going to change any more deadlines. But he's still thinking about new sectoral sanctions, made some news around copper. No telling what the futures are going to do now. And is still looking at some massive tariffs on the pharmaceutical industry a year from now. So, I mean, for a guy who's getting bored with them, he sure seems to be doing more and more and more around them. And so I think we are into a tariff cycle that will not end in his presidency. And so buckle up and get used to it. I think it's one of his favorite words. He said so. And it dominated, I think, the news coming out of this cabinet meeting.
Well, so whether or not we want to characterize it as boredom, Jeannie, what about just the notion that President Trump seems to be losing patience, not just on the efforts to find trade deals, but also other deals he was pursuing, like an end to the war between Russia and Ukraine? Is he also, again, in this cabinet meeting, expressed some displeasure with Russian President Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, I think he made some news here on this Ukraine issue. Number one, he refused to talk about or to say whether Pete Hegseth had told him in advance about the pause on munitions to Ukraine. That was notable because he, the other day, as we know, told Vladimir Zelensky he did not know about that in advance. So the fact he refused to say, I thought, was notable. And also notable to your point, Kaylee, was the idea, to me at least, that a U.S. president was shocked that Vladimir Putin is not good for his word. And so to me, that speaks volumes about Donald Trump as somewhat of an optimist, and now suddenly seems to be shocked that he can't count on Vladimir Putin. I also think the third thing I would say about this is, who is losing in the Trump administration on foreign policy? Those are the isolationists. This is a president who is now clearly gone with the hawks, both in Iran and now it seems to be as you look at Ukraine and Russia. And this is at a time when, of course, the isolationists and the far right wing of the MAGA are unhappy about another thing they talked about, which was Jeffrey Epstein. So not a good day or a good week for the more right, far right on the MAGA wing here.
He got really upset with the Jeff Epstein question, in fact, and asked the reporter why they would even ask such a thing. Rick, we learned that Benjamin Netanyahu is coming back to the White House tonight. This was another tidbit that the president dropped. We later learned from Netanyahu's government that they would meet at 6 p.m. That meeting has now been moved up to 4:30 p.m. What do you make of the return trip to the White House? Will it result in a ceasefire announcement?
Well, a lot is on the risk for the ceasefire. One, I think the president is sincere in wanting to get peace in the region. And I think that there's a great reward for that, because if he can establish a ceasefire and an end to the war with Gaza between Israel and the Palestinians, then it unlocks potentially a Abraham Accord, not just with Saudi Arabia that the president has really been anxious to do, but also with other potential countries like Syria in the region, now that diplomatic relations have been renewed with them. So he's got a real gambit going in the Middle East, and he wants to ride the momentum that he's got. And I don't think BB is getting out of town until he gets a deal on these ceasefires with Gaza.
Mm-hmm. Well, and for President Trump, Jeannie, it's also the pursuit of the Nobel Peace Prize, right? Is that ultimately what he wants with everything we just discussed, Ukraine as one example, but the Middle East is another?
That's right. And we've also seen he would like to get it for the peace between India and Pakistan, however long that lasts. And that was one of the notable things we heard from Benjamin Netanyahu and the president last night. But to me, the most notable thing we heard last night was the question about the day after, when Donald Trump deferred to Benjamin Netanyahu, and then Benjamin Netanyahu talked about sort of a removal or a choice that Palestinians could make about their future, but left off that choice was a Palestinian state. And so, you know, missing from Benjamin Netanyahu's idea of what the future and choices could hold is this idea of a two-state solution, which is probably the only solution we should be thinking about long-term, of course, as it pertains to the Middle East. And so that was, I think, the biggest news last night. And why Donald Trump is deferring to Benjamin Netanyahu on that, I think that's a major question that the U.S. and the administration has to answer.
All right, Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis, Bloomberg Politics contributors and our political panel today. Thank you for joining us here.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're joined by a guest we haven't seen in a while. Mick Mulvaney is back here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio now. He's, of course, former acting White House chief of staff, former OMB director, former Republican congressman from South Carolina, co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus. Welcome back, sir. Good to see you. As always, with this conversation we just had, knowing that President Trump is fresh off of a massive legislative victory, the one big beautiful bill having passed, hard fought, yes, but ultimately passed by the deadline he wanted. Is the hardest work still ahead of him with everything we've just discussed, trying to get what he wants on trade in the world in terms of geopolitics?
The hardest legislative work is done. I don't see anything else passing of any real significance. Now, they do have another reconciliation bullet. I know that's real deep in the weeds, but keep in mind there's actually two chances at reconciliation this year. So they've got another sort of bullet in the gun if they decide to try and do something else with reconciliation. I've not heard much about that. But I think the legislative work is done. Everybody knew once the big, beautiful bill passed, that was pretty much the end of it. So now it shifts back to what Trump really likes doing anyway, which is the executive stuff. Look, is going to be dealing with Vladimir Putin hard? Yes. Is trying to negotiate peace in the Middle East hard? Yes, it is. Is it harder than the one big, beautiful bill? Probably. So listen, it's not going to get easier, but it's not an easy job to begin with. But I think the legislative work is probably finished. Certainly the appetite, I think, in the House and the Senate to do with anything else that massive is very, very low. They want to start running for re-election. But there's going to be a lot of stuff to do, to your point.
I want to ask you about the influence or lack thereof of the Freedom Caucus, which you helped to found.
Yeah.
You watched all of this unfold last week, from Andy Harris to Chip Roy. Hell no was the answer. We're not going to get jammed by the Senate. We know there were a lot of side
deals. A dollar for every time I had said that.
Well, so bring us home on this, because there are a lot of questions about whether the Freedom Caucus that you helped to found is still relevant.
Well, it's certainly relevant. Any group that can sort of stick together is relevant, especially when you've got a margin of just a handful of votes in the House. Any group of four or five members who can really stick together can sort of change an outcome. And I think the Freedom Caucus, individual members of the caucus did play important roles. I think Chip Roy played an important role in trying to, you know, make the bill better when it was in the House. Yeah. And certainly the fear of the Freedom Caucus of walking on the bill when it came out of the Senate did influence how far to the center maybe the Senate would go. But if the criticism is that the Freedom Caucus is different with Donald Trump in the White House, the answer is yes, it is. We started as a fiscally conservative group. If Barack Obama had offered that exact same bill, I don't think that the Freedom Caucus would have supported it. They are the sort of the foot soldiers for the Trump presidency. They have been since the first term. So they are less about spending now and more about MAGA. You know, one of the pieces I read that I thought was very insightful was that this is absolutely Trump's party now. Okay, it is. There are still going to be folks talking about spending less money and all that and efficiencies and so, but this is Trump's party. Whatever Trump says, Republicans are for now, the party is for. We are now for massive tariffs on copper, period. Wow. End of story. Until next week when we're not, right? But right now we are. And I think the Freedom Caucus is along for the ride, just like everybody else.
But on the subject of spending cuts, which obviously they did not get as many as they want in the reconciliation bill, do you see real opportunity for them to get it elsewhere in the form of rescissions, because we aren't necessarily seeing much advancement on the rescission package that already passed the House and the Senate? Major question as to whether you can get adequate support.
I will buy Joe dinner if the Senate passes that rescissions package.
What about Kaylee?
So, well, like if I say I'm going to buy a nice young lady dinner, okay, people are going to accuse me of being inappropriate. So, you know, I'm going to like, no, I'll buy Joe dinner but whatever. Like, look, no, the rescissions package is not going to pass.
Just this one or
no?
Will
no, I don't think any
because
of them
Democrats
will.
Democrats are needed to write a budget.
Here's why, okay? Spending is bipartisan. It has to be, because a spending bill takes 60 votes in the Senate. A rescission vote only takes 50. Okay, it's a special rule. It's another one of those. It's like reconciliation in that sense. So if you're a Democrat and you cut a deal with the Senate, your Republican members just a year ago to get a spending package passed, and then the Republicans go off by themselves without you and sort of thumb their nose at you and say, well, we're gonna undo this spending that we just agreed to. What do you think that does for next year's spending package? It kills it. Then you end up with CRs and all this kind of stuff. We talked about, is there any other legislation going to get passed? No. And especially if the rescissions package passes. Keep in mind, and I lose track of the days, I think the rescission package dies
July 18th.
Days. I had 10 days in my head or something, whatever it is. So look, Washington is always better at doing nothing than doing something. And if the Senate can sit on their hands for the next 10 days and say, oh, well, we just ran out of time on rescissions, I just don't see them doing it because of the dynamics within that building.
Do you believe Donald Trump when he says August 1st, even if this was always the date, doesn't move again? There's no extensions?
I think somebody said yesterday, it might have been on this network, that the market just has given up now. Mm. They throw their hands up and they don't even listen to what Trump says anymore because right. they don't rely on it. You know, if you relied on July 9th, then you're off. You can't invest based on that.
That's right.
You can't trade at least based on the August 1st. You throw your hands up and say, look, it's gonna come as it does. Do I think the August date can change? Sure, it should. Did I predict that the July 9th date would change? Yes. Why? Because this is the reason no one else got. He doesn't like strange numbers. He doesn't like July 9th. He likes July 1st. He likes July 4th. He likes August 1st. They're easier to sell. It's a black and white. It's sort of thing. July 9th is what is that, like a Wednesday?
It's tomorrow.
That's not good for news. That's not good for marketing. So look,
that's why he brought Japan from 24% to 25%, right?
Well, just listen, make it round.
We talked about that. You joked. Did he do that? By the way, I haven't heard that.
Yes.
So I go back to 2017 when we're trying to negotiate the corporate taxes on the first tax cut, mm-hmm. and I think Cohn came back. We wanted 20%, and Gary Cohn and Steven Mnuchin, who were leading the negotiations, came back and said, "Well, Mr. President, we think we get 21." He's like, 21, I can't sell 21. 20 or 25. 20 or 25, wow. guys. It's not 21. So yeah, that's how he operates. It works for him. But the point is, you can't trade off of it. Could August 1st change? Yes. It's not going to be August 8th. It could be September 1st. But yeah, there's going to be a certain uncertainty in what comes out of the White House. It is the cultivated, he loves the term strategic ambiguity. Mm. He doesn't want to get pinned down and he's not going to. If deals go forward, great. If they don't, we might look at changing the date. We might not. Who knows?
Right. Another 2-3 months before we see you?
I hope not.
Okay. Well, so no.
Are you guys here every day?
We try to be.
Oh, yes.
Mick Mulvaney, if you don't recognize the name or the voice, you know the business card. We don't have to do that right now, do we? Thank you, Mick. It's great to have you. Alongside Kaylee Lyons, I'm Joe Matthew. This is Bloomberg. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.